history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, seemingly ordinary Americans who have done extraordinary things on our behalf. And those are the kind of stories that should be told, right? We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their experiences so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take these journeys back in time, we learn so much. We are educated, we are entertained, and so frequently we leave inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. My plan today was to introduce you to an incredible World War II veteran named Bob Izumi, but we're going to save that for next time because of a development in the last week that many thought would never happen. The discovery of the cruiser USS Indianapolis 3.5 miles deep in the Pacific Ocean. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard about the Indianapolis and its unique distinctions before. If you're a student of World War II history, you know that the Indy, on a secret mission in which it set speed records, delivered the components of the nuclear bomb to the island of Tinian at the end of July 1945. The bomb would be assembled there, loaded onto the Enola Gay, and dropped on Hiroshima, hastening the end of the war. But what people here in the U.S. did not know was that the ship that had delivered that crucial cargo had been sunk by a Japanese submarine. And that wasn't the worst of it. The torpedoed Indianapolis sank in less than 12 minutes. There was no distress call, and the Navy didn't know the ship had sunk until 3.5 days later, when a pilot named Chuck Gwynn was on a routine patrol flight and spotted some survivors floating in the water. By that time, it was too late for so many members of that 1,200-man crew. Approximately 900 had survived the torpedo attack, but over the days that followed, two-thirds of those survivors succumbed to several factors, the most famous of which is the worst shark attack in recorded history. Official Navy records say that 317 men survived all of it, and today we're going to hear from one of them, as well as the son of one of the 879 sailors who died in what ranks as the single greatest loss of life at sea in U.S. Navy history. Before we get to those special guests and get their take on this new development, let's hear briefly from the man who made it possible, Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, whose research vessel Petrel made this find 2 years after a similar discovery, exploring the wreck of the Japanese battleship Musashi, which had been sunk by Allied forces during the Battle of Leyte Gulf in October 1944.
Well, we've done a number of these explorations to try to find sunken warships. So we try to do these both as really exciting examples of underwater archaeology and as tributes to the brave men that went down in these ships. Once we find a target on the bottom of the ocean, then we send down an ROV to go down to the bottom and take high-definition video of what we find. So we're looking forward, we're excited to do a video feed from the bottom of the ocean like we did with the Musashi to show everybody what the wreck looks like now.
So we can look forward to more from Paul Allen and his group, but the images released so far are breathtaking. I have some of those along with links to Paul Allen's site posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Allen's group is working closely with the Naval History and Heritage Command, including Dr. Richard Holver, a historian, who explains why the recent discovery of a log from an LST that had crossed paths with the Indy on that fateful day helped lead this team to a new location that past searchers had not previously considered.
All the paperwork is lost. There was no distress signal that went out. So basically, we had nothing but the recollections of the crew, the survivors. So it was really an imprecise location at the beginning. When Captain McVeigh was picked up, first thing he said, we were exactly as rooted. So he was saying they were exactly where they were supposed to be. So that is where the Navy position came from. Like, plugging all the data in, that's probably where Indianapolis should have been. But we don't have any of the supporting, you know, historical documents. Their deck logs were gone. All their records were gone. They spent 4 days in the water afterwards. A lot of the primary actors didn't live through it. So it's as a historian, there are a lot of missing pieces into that original sinking location. With LST-779, it's important to give you another data plot in that route. I mean, they reportedly were passed by Indianapolis around 1200, 1300, anywhere between 12 and 1400 on the day of the sinking, so about 11 hours before Indianapolis was sunk. So that gives you, if you can figure out where LST-779 was, that gives you another data point on that route that can give you a better idea.
It turned out to be the best idea. That clue moved the search grid further west from previous efforts and eventually right to that find, 3.5 miles deep. The photos released by Paul Allen's team show the ship's bell, some of the guns, and even the cruiser's number, 35, painted on the hull. Retired Rear Admiral Sam Cox, the director of the Naval History and Heritage Command, puts it in perspective.
I would prefer people to focus on the heroism and the valor of the crew, which actually began long before the ship was torpedoed and sunk. She had 10 battle stars in some of the most brutal combat throughout the entire course of the Pacific War. Even in a great tragedy like this one, there is valor, there is bravery, there are also lessons learned, in this case many of them, that need to be preserved and remembered. And in the case of this crew that made the ultimate sacrifice, you know, what they did needs to be remembered and not just for getting torpedoed and sunk. They were heroes.
And in a little bit, we're going to hear from the son of one of those heroes who lost his life in this tragedy. But if you really want to understand the whole story of this ship, I highly recommend the documentary that came out last year after a decade of dedication from director Sarah Vladek, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. You can watch it online. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And after listening to this trailer, I'm pretty sure you'll want to.
We were never allowed to tell the disaster.
I never talked to my wife or my kids for 25 years about this.
Indianapolis changed history. It was a ship that changed history, but the men paid the price.
As far as I'm concerned, it should be told what really happened out there in the water. I started into the Navy when I was 16, and I saw all 10 battles.
I saw the flag raised, Mount Suribachi.
And I personally helped load and unload components of the atomic bomb.
So on the 30th of July, we were hit by two torpedoes from a submarine and sunk.
Next thing I know, the ship's going right out from under me.
All I did was just walk over the side of the ship and into the water.
I didn't jump off the ship. The ship left me.
I opened my eyes under the water and I could see this ship was coming down on top of me.
I never did know how to swim, and the Navy never taught me how to swim.
And here's all these sharks going around. Come right across your legs like that.
It was chaos.
We couldn't understand why we weren't rescued.
A lot of them lost the will to live.
You look at their eyes, they're lost. You see people when they're not there.
Us guys decided, well, hell, that's where we're going to die.
Then there on that fourth day, I said, I hear a plane. And we began to splash water. We began to yell. We began to pray. Everything. And seemingly when he got to a point that had he gone any further, he would have gone over. But you know what he did? He made a dive.
How did I make it with nothing to eat, no water to drink, no sleep for 5 nights? Tell them the Lord was with me.
If somebody wrote this up as fiction, nobody would believe it happened.
People don't realize the politics in the armed forces.
All the headlines were about the captain being court-martialed.
Many a head should have rolled before they ever got to the captain.
It's the story that's not been told. Those don't want to remember. They don't want to recall this. It's too much. But I'm a dummy. I think it ought to be told.
And it is told so powerfully in that documentary, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. We're going to hear what Indianapolis survivor Adolfo Celaya has to say about the ship's discovery. And if you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener, you might remember him. His nickname is pretty distinctive, Harpo, because of the shaggy hair he had as a boy that evoked Harpo Marx. He convinced his father to sign for him and joined the Navy at the age of 17. Here's what Harpo experienced aboard the USS Indianapolis on July 30th, 1945.
The big explosion happened right where I was at. The thing that saved me was a blanket that I had on, because when I woke up, there was no blanket. The fire had taken it off.
Were you burned at all?
I had burns on my legs and my hands, where I had my hands out, but my hair was almost all gone. My eyelashes were gone there then. So it was a pretty good sized blast, and it killed a lot of sailors around me. The only thing that saved me, I think, was the blanket. I didn't have a life jacket. I didn't have anything with me. In fact, I only had my T-shirt and my shorts. I didn't have shoes. I have nothing. And I told Santos, I got to go down below, Santos, because I don't have a life jacket. And he said, you can't. He said, the ship is going down. I said, I just came from the front of it. He said, the whole front end is gone. He said, I said, what? He said, oh, yeah. He said, so I stayed with him. We both jumped off. When I hit the water, I hit something, and I thought I had hit Santos. And I thought I'd killed him, you know, so I didn't see Santos for 3 days. I had always thought I had knocked him out or something. But after 3 days, we met up with another group, and here he was. I found him there. I saw the shark coming around. I mean, everybody would, when they say sharks, they start kicking and all that stuff. And I kind of stayed in the middle of everything, and except when I found Santos Peña, I went around and went over to look for him. But otherwise, they had nets hanging on there, but the nets were very rough on you because the ocean was pretty rough. So on the nets, I would get in between the nets and swim with it. And so that helped me quite a bit, too.
And I imagine the day that you were rescued in August of 1945 has to be the greatest day of your life, because none of the rest of the days would have happened if that day didn't happen. How did they get you out of there, and how great did that feel?
It's kind of a dazed deal. I mean, because they come down with the landing barges to pick you up with a hook, you know, and put you up in the landing barge. And then when they took you right up next to the ship that was going to put you in, which the Bassett ocean was so rough that the landing barge was going up and down all the time. And so they had to put a kind of a hammock deal, you know, the deal that they put down, put you in there and tie you up, and then they haul you up to the top, you know. So I remember the sailors that took care of me, they were on this Bassett ship. Oh, they did a heck of a job. They gave me a little glass of water, probably about two swallows, and I told them, no. I said, one more? And no, you can't have it. So little by little, they got me back on.
They knew you couldn't handle that much. And yeah. I have to imagine you hadn't had anything to eat or drink for more than 3 days, right?
Oh, 4 days. Well, all the time I was there, I never had anything to eat or to drink.
So I imagine there had to be plenty of moments where you thought you were going to die.
I thought so.
What? How did you keep hope alive? I mean, were you out there praying? Were you trying to talk to other people?
Everybody was praying, but I had them. Here in San Jose, my mother had gotten me a St. Anthony medal.
Mm-hmm.
And that medal that she gave me, I put it in my mouth. That medal stayed in my mouth all the time. I can remember that.
I want to get a sense of how tough it was for you to recover, because when your body goes through something like that, it does take a while to recover from those extreme circumstances. How long did it take you to get back to health?
About 4 months, three or four. I spent 3 months in Long Beach Naval Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays they call it something else, post-traumatic or whatever.
Post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yeah. In those days, they called you, they said you were crazy or something like that, you know. they didn't bring up this the way they put it up now, you know.
No, and every time a veteran like Harpo Celaya shares transparently about those struggles, it has the potential to help another vet who's facing similar things. If you pull up our complete original interview with Harpo at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll hear how he returned to school after World War II and led the underdog, undersized team from Florence High School in Arizona to an improbable state championship in basketball in 1947. That story is captured in the book Harpo, War Survivor, Basketball Wizard by Charles Clemens. I have that linked for you, too. But when we come back, we're going to hear what Harpo has to say about his ship, the Indianapolis, being found 72 years after that incredible ordeal he survived. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.